Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the last cast of the decade over here at Quiet Speculation. We are doing our first cast in quite a while. I'm back from a little bit of a medical leave, and I'm joined by Sam and Crowberry here to kick things off with our last cast of the decade and hopefully the first cast of many. We're going to get back on our regular schedule, planning on likely every Monday from here on. We'll aim to get a cast in at 9 Eastern. So plan accordingly if you want to listen live. We do obviously edit these and post them subsequently within a day or two. But if you can and you want to tune in live, we love the live listeners and the questions that come in. So Sam Crowberry, thanks for joining. Welcome back.
Yo.
It's good to be back.
We've got a lot to cover, all just around Theros Beyond Death spoilers. It has been a pretty much a whirlwind of a day. It was kind of a slow roll through the Christmas holiday last week. We did get some cards over the last roughly 10 days, I would say. But today the Wizards ramped it up and we got quite a bit to talk about. So I'll go ahead and get started. I did post a link over to the Scryfall spoiler list. If you want to get out there and take a look at kind of everything that's been spoiled, there's been a lot of stuff that's been sneaking out through different avenues. This is one of my least favorite aspects of spoilers, is how I do love the fact that content creators get the spoilers, but I wish that there was a centralized location that we could go to and see them once they are spoiled. So anyway, Scryfall does a nice job of that. We'll go ahead and use their link for reference. I guess we could start, maybe we start with the biggest bang from today, which I think was Purphoros, Bronze Blooded. It was spoiled about maybe 4 hours ago from casting time this afternoon. And it reads as 1 red and 4 generic. It's a 7/6 indestructible legendary enchantment creature god. As long as devotion is red devotion to red is less than 5, it isn't a creature. And then here's the kicker. So it's basically a sneak attack on a stick, a sneak attack light. It gives your creatures haste. And then for 2 generic and a red, you can activate an ability to put a red creature or artifact creature, which is kind of interesting, from your hand onto the battlefield, and then you sacrifice it at the beginning of the next end step. I thought we'd start with this one because, for one, I'm just going to put my thoughts out there to get them on the table. I think this is one of the more powerful red cards we've seen in a while. It reminds me, obviously, of Sneak Attack. It's got a very similar ability. It's a little bit more restrictive because of the red creature or artifact as opposed to just any creature. And it's also a little more expensive to use. But generally speaking, for Standard and Pioneer and really even, I guess, Modern and all the way down through the Eternal playables, this card seems pretty good. What do you guys, what's your initial takes here?
I'll start us off because I feel pretty strongly about this. I think red is going to make a real comeback in Theros. We just like today have seen, I think, 5 different just red, like mono red, extremely high power level cards compared to where red has been in the last like few years. Purphoros is definitely going to make a splash. There's just no way you can print a 5-mana 7/6 that gives other creatures haste and has sneak attack stapled to it and expect it to not see play. So the first thing that jumps to mind is like playing this with Ilharg in Standard. But there are tons of really good options. I mean, you can put in Nicol Bolas off of his ability, or not Nicol Bolas, I'm sorry. Niv-Mizzet, the 5-mana Niv-Mizzet, right? It's Niv-Mizzet, right? The 5-color guy.
Yep.
Okay, yeah. So you can draw a whole bunch of cards. Like, that's a great way to cheat that creature into the battlefield and give it haste and crack for a ton of damage. People have pointed out that there's just like all sorts of ways you can kill your opponent really fast with this. Like, you can put you have Fires of Invention on turn 4, and then turn 5 you can play this in a Cavalier of Flame. And then you can activate Purphoros because you have all your mana still and put in another Cavalier of Flame, and that's 19 damage. And if you still have 2 mana, which you should because you paid, you should have 5 mana this turn, and you can activate Cavalier of Flame, which is 22 damage. So that's a pretty hefty swing. And that's not like a crazy unreasonable thing to happen. I think like Big Red is definitely going to be a real standard deck, especially because it's just got so much. Like the Ox of Agonis, which, you know, we'll have to talk about all of these kind of one by one because so many of them have more context than just being like a big red role player. There's the Storm Herald card, which brings back like enchantments just until the end of turn. And then there's Wrath of Storm, which is 2 and 2 red to deal 4 damage to each creature and planeswalker. This card, I think, might be getting slept on a little bit right now because think about Languish. You know, I mean, Languish is an excellent magic card. And we have gotten some better wraths since then, like Kaya's Wrath, that are currently in standard. But this hits creatures and planeswalkers and is in red, like a color that traditionally does not have access to that.
So, it reminds me a little bit of Hour of Devastation. From the set Hour of Devastation. It does very similar. I think that was 5 mana for 5 damage to creatures and planeswalkers, and you exiled if it died. It has a very similar feel to that. It almost assuredly will see some amount of play, given the spectrum of planeswalkers that we're seeing in standard today. Even with Oko obviously being banned, it might have been a little too late. We got Field of Rune, and we got this card, which might have actually combated Field of the Dead and Oko pretty well. But regardless, I agree with you. Mono Red's looking really strong, and we are probably going to need to cover each of these individually. To bring it back to Purphoros really quickly, it actually started on Star City at $9.99 very, very briefly. It was up. I was trying to refresh earlier and get it, and it sold out before I could even check out. I think anyone that got $9.99 copies at $9.99 are probably going to be feeling pretty good about that.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
I was shocked actually that it was that low. I thought for sure it would be $19.99, to be honest. But Purphoros is really strong. I think it's, of any of the cards we've had spoiled so far, personally, I think it's going to make the most impact. And in fact, I could see it even being the type of card that, you know, creates or revives an archetype. Like you said, I don't know if it's red aggro or just mono red stompy, something along those lines. One last card too, Sam, that just to tack on to what you were saying, with like Ilgark and all those, there's also Dracuset, the Maw of Flames, which it's got 3 red in its casting cost. So if you've got one other creature or really anything that's got 1 red mana in its cost, you're going to activate with Cavalier of Flames or Dracuseth. If you're using the sneak attack ability, you're actually going to be able to activate Purphoros and use it as a creature as well, because you'll have your devotion equal to 5. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, there's a lot of sources for devotion in standard right now already, and it's definitely possible that a lot of those could go up in value because of these cards. It's definitely something to keep an eye on, especially like the 3 mana, 3 devotion rares from Throne of Eldraine.
Torbrand seems like a solid, if not great, auto-include into a mono-red deck like this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Torbrand like absolutely works along with like what this kind of big red deck would want to do, and then brings along 3 pips of devotion, which makes it quite powerful. I think Purphoros right now is the most expensive card previewing in this set. It's currently on TCG Player for $35. But the set, honestly, a lot of the previews are extremely expensive right now. And of course, you know, that can never last, but it means that we're most likely looking at a set that is similar to Throne of Eldraine in power level, despite what Wizards of the Coast previously stated that this was going to be a bit laid back.
All it takes, as we know, is maybe 1 or 2 cards that just kind of break the format wide open. So
from what we've seen so far, I would not be surprised to see a card like
same,
that.
Same. Well, really quick, why don't we'll jump over to another red mythic that was spoiled, Ox of Agoness. It reads 2 red, 3 generic. It's a 4/2 ox creature. And when it enters the battlefield, you discard your hand, then draw 3. It also has this new escape mechanic built in. So for 2 red, you exile 8 other cards from your graveyard. And when it escapes, it enters with a 1/1 counter on it. So it comes back as a 5/3. The ability to recycle, you know, in a mono red, especially like a burn type of, or even aggro burn, either one of those or combined, you're going to burn through your hand really quickly, right? And so the ability to quote unquote discard your hand, which in a best case scenario, you might actually not be needing to discard anything. And then you're going to go ahead and draw 3. So you're going to reload, and then the escape built in, you can recycle those burn cards that don't have flashback in your graveyard. You can turn those into another ox and load up. It also works great with Reanimator. It works great with Flashback. It basically works great with anything where your graveyard matters. So I actually really, I think this card's going to be one. It reminds me a lot of Bedlam Reveler, which was, I believe, Shadows of Innistrad. It had a very similar mechanic. In fact, I think it was the same concept where you discarded your hand and drew some cards off of it. So we'll see if this is playable. These type of cards in general, red, I think they get slept on. They often end up as bulk, kind of early on, and then they might make an impact in a particular frame or a particular build.
So as someone who has piloted Dredge to a lot of strong finishes, I've won regionals in Michigan with Dredge, and Michigan's a very stacked state. I've been one round away from top eighting a Grand Prix with Dredge. Looking at this card, I say that this card is nuts. It does require you to exile 8 other cards from your graveyard, which is a large number. But so essentially, you're going to have to dredge one time before you can actually cast this card. But that is perfectly fine. Dredge's look bread and butter is flashing back Conflagrate, which is not something you're looking to do on turn one. And you ideally don't want to do it turn two either. That's something you usually do a little bit later when you've built up some card advantage there. Unless you have like a problematic creature that you have to kill. So like this is something that is more likely coming down on turn three, unless you get like a solid clean turn one dredge, then you can bring it down on turn two. But just the text in this card is insane. Discarding your hand when you have like Life from the Loam to build it back and stuff is just fine. And getting 3 dredge triggers off of that is definitely nuts. Only having to pay 2 red is exactly what Dredge wants, because you're not going to be working with more than 2 or 3, maybe 4 mana until the game has been pretty much decided at that point. Because once you have like 5 lands on the board and you're playing Dredge, you've either won or you've lost at that point. But at 2 mana, this card is just nuts. A 5/3 you can play in your graveyard? Like, are you kidding? This triggers Prize Amalgam. This is so nuts.
It's, right. Yeah, no, it's I agree. It's definitely... The escape aspect of it is what makes it so much more intriguing than the comparison I made to Bedlam Reveler, because that was very simply discard and then draw some cards and you get like a cool creature out of it. But this is reusable. It's also, to your point, Sam, you can discard this into the graveyard and then bring it back later for those additional triggers, which I think that is something that probably will go undervalued or under the radar early, and then someone's going to realize that more widely, and it'll get play tested and possibly break things wide open with it in the Dredge world again. I love your meme, by the way. You compared it to Hogak, so it's Oxgak, I guess is how you pronounce that. So that's a good that's one. Correct. I like that.
Go ahead, Kroger.
I'm just looking at this Ox and seeing, and it's definitely intentional that it's 8 other cards, but just thinking of all the potential in like Legacy, Vintage, when you have cards like Lion's Eye Diamond, this gets a lot stronger when you have enablers like that. Holy moly.
Speaking of broken Legacy enablers, even though, so real quick, just to finish up what we're saying about Ox. Ox is currently retailing for $18 in CCG Player, which is a little bit high. I think if it gets to the point where people are underrating this closely to where they were doing with Arclight Phoenix, where it was like $4 or $5 as the set came out, then it's going to be an excellent buy. At the time, at $18, it's a little risky since it's most likely more of an Eternal player, although this could also be like a reasonable standard card. So not a terrible buy right now, but probably better to hold off and see if it dips down a little bit more.
No, totally agreed. I like it at like, to be honest with you, I like it more at like a $2 range, because Arclight got that low for whatever reason, and I just feel like if it could find its way between like $2 and $5, to me feels high. And the only reason I'm saying that is because we don't know what the rest of the set's going to look like, but just a hypothesis that there's going to be, probably enough cards to kind of suppress. You're going to have the cards like Purphoros that are going to take up a decent amount of expected value, and then it's going to suppress this over time. So I would even aim a little lower.
I definitely agree with your point in terms of thinking about this as like a long-term goal, but what I think is actually a fairly direct comparison to Arclight Phoenix, where if this card does get down to $5 in the previous season and the set comes out, my prediction is that the Dredge will top 8 some events with this card because it's insanely powerful. And the card will just spike in response, and it won't have the staying power, because you're absolutely right. With the way the set is looking so far, we can't just have every mythic be, $15 or $20. It's just not going to be reasonable. But it could go back up to $15 from your $5, And then you have a very, you know, a relatively brief window of most likely 2 weeks where you can buy list your cards for, you know, $10 or $11 and make a decent chunk there.
For what it is worth, the and I don't know if you saw this, Sam, Ox actually did go up at $4.99 on SCG. So it's out of stock.
That fiving more, man. What am I doing?
No, SCG had some really, they had some really competitive prices on the things that got spoiled today. Again, didn't I was not able to get any of these, but I was refreshing aggressively on Purphoros and got to the checkout screen and then failed. So anyway, it was out of stock at $5. We'll see if it'll be interesting to keep an eye on, because if they put that back up at $5 and it keeps selling out there, then you're probably right. $5 is probably, you know, probably a pretty good starting point out of the gates, and especially if it does hit on like a dredge. It also has an interesting and I don't know if this will find its way into standard or not, but there is an interesting synergy here with Arclight Phoenix to be able to load up your graveyard with Arclight. You know, there's already some enablers for Arclight today, and I don't know if that makes Arclight an interesting kind of like a speculative target, but worth, I think it's at least worth monitoring that Arclight works with this and see if there's any sort of resurgence there, one more resurgence for Arclight in standard before it finds its way out next year.
Oh yeah, it is still in standard, isn't it? Arclight's not that expensive either. They're like $9 now.
Yeah, they've dropped quite a bit because of they got printed in that like guild kit or something like that. So
yeah.
Anyway, all right. So moving on, couple more.
Real quick, the next card I wanted to segue into real quick there actually is because we were talking about potentially playing this card with like Lion's Eye Diamond and other broken legacy cards. One card that is absolutely going to see play with Lion's Eye Diamond and other broken legacy cards is Underworld Breach. Underworld Breach.
There it is.
One in a red for an enchantment that says each non-land card in the graveyard has escape. The escape cost is equal to the card's mana cost plus exile 3 cards from your graveyard. At the beginning of the end step, sacrifice Underworld Breach. This is like a Yogg-Will that doesn't hit lands, but it's also on an enchantment. So that means like cards that enter the graveyard after this is on the battlefield still get the benefit from that. So this is broken. This is definitely just insanely busted. Let me just paint a little picture for you. You go this on turn 2, and you cast Lion's Eye Diamond, and then you crack Lion's Eye Diamond, putting 5 or 6 cards, I guess 6, maybe 7, depending on if you're on the draw, into the graveyard. And then you cast Brain Freeze out of your graveyard, and you target yourself. And this form count is 3. So you mill 9, but you only had to exile 3 cards. That's really good. And you still have your plus a mana on that effect. So, you know, some pile of Lion's Eye Diamonds and maybe like Dark Rituals and stuff is going to break the crap out of this card. And then eventually you Brain Freeze your opponent.
I just want to point out here that there's a narrative through point where we said Lion's Eye Diamond twice on a couple of these cards. So do with that information what you will.
Yeah, I was pretty low on Lion's Eye Diamond before, but that is actually a pretty reasonable point that Lion's Eye Diamond might be about to get broken again. I don't think anyone foresaw them putting flashback on a bunch of cards that could potentially be broken by fast mana, but here we are.
A Lion's Eye Diamond is always one of those cards that just finds its way back into the limelight, I think. Legacy and Vintage have been super quiet lately with all the, you know, all the lack of, or well, I was gonna say all the support that's been taken away, but there really is no more support for it moving forward with SCG pulling it out. So I'd be interested to see if Lion's Eye Diamond will actually move in response to some of that, you know, some of those speculations, because those would be the only two formats that this would truly truly find its way into, and with Legacy and Vintage kind of quieting down right now, you might be holding that for a while, I guess, is where I'm going with this.
I'll just point out that a couple of my favorite retailers are low on stock of Lion's Eye Diamond.
I imagine a lot of people are probably low on it, because I would hypothesize that as soon as that card, as soon as Underworld Breach was spoiled, people with deeper pockets probably bought some copies. It's just a speculation there, but
yeah, I think Lion's Eye Diamond and, you know, other expensive reserve list cards like could very easily specifically Lion's Eye Diamond in this case could get, you know, some speculators could buy it, the price could go up even like $100 or so, But I just don't know if there's enough legacy players or there's enough people who are like don't own Lions Eye Diamonds and want to own Lions Eye Diamonds even after this gets printed. Even if it's the best deck in Legacy, like I don't know if there's a whole bunch of people who are gonna flock to buy Lions Eye Diamonds, especially with how trigger happy Wizards of the Coast has been with the ban list recently and how a lot of formats don't feel quite finished. It feels like a lot of formats need a couple of more bans to get to where they need to be. So I think people would be pretty averse to spending, you know, shelling out $1,000 for Lions Eye Diamonds right now.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking $150 to $200 per copy. I agree. I guess what I'm saying is, if you're out there listening and you're thinking about what to speculate on, I personally am risk averse on this, and I think Lions Eye Diamond, while it is reserveless, making it a little, you know, safer in that regard, I just think you're going to be stuck holding it, and there's going to be quicker return, you know, opportunities elsewhere. So that's my take on it. But that being said,
Underworld Breach currently retailing for about $8. So it's pretty high for a card that's almost definitely not getting busted in Standard. It doesn't even look really playable in Standard unless like some really specific combination of cards gets printed. Maybe good in Modern. There's no way to know yet. So if someone breaks that, keep an eye on it. But I think this card's going to be a bulk rare first, like maybe $2, unless it really like breaks out of the scene in Modern very quickly.
I agreed. Yeah, and I'm just looking at SCG. It was at $6 or $5.99 out of stock there. I think it was originally $4.99, and then it sold out, and they bumped to $5.99, sold out again. I agree. I think that's too high. I would wait on this one. I think it will make its way down to a bulk level pricing, $1 or $2 tops. And then it might make for a pretty good speculation, especially in the extended art foil realm. Those are always kind of more intriguing just because the supply on them is already going to naturally be pretty low. Wrapping up on that.
Just for posterity reasons, I'm going to clip that and keep it separate just so we can have it for later.
That's good. Be happy to go back to that and revisit it. So the last red card, we talked about the board wipe. I don't think there's a whole lot that needs to be said on top of it. It's a 4 mana, 2 red, 2 generic sorcery, deals 4 damage to all creatures and planeswalkers. Seems good. It works really well with Torbrand. If you have Torbrand on the field, you get that extra 2 damage that could make a difference for, particularly for some of those higher loyalty planeswalkers like Nissa. You could take her out and you know, deal with it that way. It's a little more efficient. It also is obviously great for combating aggro and some of these go wide strategies that we've been seeing. So I think that card's going to be a role player throughout its standard lifetime. I don't know that it'll ever be worth more than maybe $3 to $5, but I think it's going to be a steady seller all the way through. So
yep, that's kind of my opinion. I definitely agree. And I think it's clear from these cards that we've seen so far that R&D is putting a big red deck in this format. Like a 4 mana red Wrath of God that is clearly extremely efficient, doesn't like interrupt with your Purphoros plan or anything. This definitely seems like it's going to be a competitive strategy.
Yeah, no, I agree with that wholeheartedly. So then the last one on the red cycle, while we're on it, might as well wrap this up because this is just kind of an interesting card. I think this makes its way into probably bulk rare status pretty quickly, but it is, I'm going to mention it mostly because it's intriguing. I'm intrigued to see what happens with red enchantments. Storm Herald, 3 mana, 1 red, 2 generic, haste. It's a 3/2, but when it enters the battlefield, you return any number of aura cards from your graveyard to the battlefield attached to creatures you control. So you basically can decide where they land, and then you exile those auras at the beginning of your next end step. If one or more of those auras would leave the battlefield, you have to exile them instead of putting them anywhere else. So not a great card. I don't think this is going to like make its way into Standard by any stretch, but it is kind of a cool card in the sense that it might be creating a new design space for Wizards where they can start doing more of a red enchantment. Historically speaking, all that we've ever seen with red enchantments are the ones that are like, you know, +3/+0 first strike and things like that. Be curious to see if we get, you know, some type of like a red enchant support down the road here through Theros, and really Theros would be the perfect place for it because of that, you know, kind of enchantment lore that it has behind it. Those were some quick thoughts I just want to throw out there on Storm Herald.
Yeah, I think it's this is the same kind of card where there just has to be a whole bunch of extremely specific stuff to get printed for this to actually be good in standard. But in modern, I think this card has some real potential. Like, I mean, imagine just going turn one, haggle, discard Eldrazi Conscription, draw a card, turn two, Desperate Ritual, Storm Herald, attach my Eldrazi Conscription to it, attack you, Annihilator 2 trigger, you lose. I'm dreaming big, obviously, but you know, that's just like kind of one of the cool things you could do with that. Maybe there's some like it is called Storm Herald. Maybe there's some sort of way you can go wide with lots of like small auras like Dragon's Mantle and stuff that draw you cards. And just be like this kind of value aura strategy where like you just play Storm Herald and you draw 8 cards or something and then you win the game there somehow. That card has to get broken to be good though, and it's probably going to get to bulk status before anyone figures out a way to break it.
Yeah, and I'll just to add to that, we're in Theros land and we are very early into spoilers and we're about to see a lot of auras, so this may be the one you don't sleep on, but time will tell.
I sleep. It's like $9 right now. It's just way too high. If it gets, there's no way it falls fast enough too to be a good spec. Because I would buy this card. I don't know. I don't think I would even bet on this card, honestly. I think I could very easily see this card inside bulk bins. So I wouldn't even buy this card for $1. But I will be watching this card very closely if something that I think can combo with it gets printed. But you're gonna have to pull the trigger extremely fast on that because you and the whole internet is gonna be looking at that. That said, there are some pretty cool looking enchantment like cards so far. Not actual, like we haven't really seen the auras yet, so you know we'll have to wait and see what we get to support this. But the payoffs are clearly there. I mean, there's Brian Giant is 6 and a blue for a 5/6 that has affinity for enchantments. That seems pretty powerful. Thirst for Meaning is always a powerful effect. It's 2 and a blue for an instant. Draw 3 cards, discard 2, unless you discard an enchantment card. So Thirst for Knowledge, except for enchantments.
Enchantments are definitely getting support. I mean, they've made that clear with these first batches of spoilers.
There's also more support for the sacrifice strategies with like Woe Strider, the 3-mana 3/2 that gives you an 0/1 goat when it ETBs. And it's got a free sacrifice effect where you can sacrifice another creature to scry one. Free sac outlets, you know, pretty good when you have support for sacrifice and standard, which we currently do, and it's on color. It's also got escape, which you know gives you value back if it ever dies or if you want to sack it to itself or something else. And there's a few cards here that you know want to be sacrificed and want you to be sacrificing stuff. Erebos himself is a big fan of that. He's the 4-mana god for 5/6, requires devotion of 5 to black to become a creature. And whenever another creature you control dies, you can pay 2 life to draw a card. Definitely good in some sort of sacrifice shell.
I was going to say, let's pivot to that because along with Purphoros, the sacrifice kind of aristocrats types archetype feels like it might be back with Woe Strider. There's enough. We've got the Priests of Forgotten Gods, which is either Ravnica Allegiance or Guilds of Ravnica. It was one of those where you could tap it, sack 2 creatures, and then it had like a whole bunch of text where you draw and people lose life and they have to sack a creature. So that's in standard. You've got Woe Strider now where you got this free kind of unlimited sack outlet, which they literally said they would never do again not long ago, and then they did it again. So basically a Viscerous Seer, but like a big sister to Viscerous Seer. And then you've actually got 2 Blood Artists in standard right now. You've got Cruel Celebrant and Vindictive Vampire. So if you've got a way with the afterlife mechanic, you can create a ton of value. You can essentially create a bunch of tokens. You can use Divine Visitation to create them as like 4/4 angels even. There's all sorts of kind of options out there. And I think for sure it's safe to assume that an aristocrat's build will be at least tested. I don't know if there's going to be enough to make it work. Obviously, we've got a bunch of spoilers still to come, but having that engine that's a free unlimited sack outlet gives you, it should give aristocrats fans hope that archetype will be back in standard
I mean, we're not losing the Cauldron Cat combo anytime soon. It's literally the set before this one. So I have to imagine that that plus the sacrifice bonuses that we're getting from this set is just going to be a deck by itself at the very least. And there's other cards around to support it. Like, exactly. I mean, making food along with something that says whenever a creature you control dies, you can pay 2 life to draw a card. That's nuts. And then Woe Strider is extremely powerful. Like, Woe Strider... just think about the comparison to Viscerous Seer was perfect. Viscerous Seer is a literal 1-mana 1/1 with no other text aside from sacrifice another creature to scry one. This is a 3-mana 3/2 that gives you another body to sacrifice, which is all you want in this kind of archetype. It has the same Viscerous Seer ability, and then it has a whole bunch of other text too that's just really good upside of, you know, escape for 5 mana to exile 4 other cards from your graveyard, which you're going to have more creatures naturally ending up there because you're a sacrifice shell, and it comes back as a 5/4. Pretty good. Erebos also has some additional text that I didn't touch on earlier that says one of the blacks sacrifice another creature to give a target creature -2/-1 until end of turn. So that's more sacrifice stuff stapled onto Erebos. This sounds like it's going to be pretty good.
So along those lines, I mean, assuming the Woe Strider and Erebos, you know, the collection of those two being spoiled along with everything that we've kind of got in terms of the support already, you mentioned it with the infinite combo with that I think it's a cat where you can like keep sacrificing and bringing it back. You put all those things together and that just seems like an archetype is already built for people to test with. I have a couple of cards in mind that I want to talk about really quickly along the lines of speculation with regards to whether an Aristocrat's archetype makes it. The first one is Seraph of the Scales. It was printed in Ravnica Allegiance, and it's a angel. It's 1 black, 1 white, and 3 generic. It's a 4/3, and it has Afterlife 2, which is the reason why I think it's you know, kind of an interesting target. I think Afterlife is going to be a really, really important mechanic if this Aristocrat's build makes its way back in, because you get that extra value every time you sacrifice every time you're sacrificing something with Afterlife, or it's dying in combat, or whatever the case may be. You're getting value that you can continue the engine and keep it moving forward. But Seraph of the Scales has also got the flying evasion to be able to help, you know, get in that chip damage, and it has 2 key abilities where it's got vigilance and death touch. You pay 1 planes for vigilance, or you pay 1 planes for, pay 1 swamp for death touch. So that card to me feels like a really intriguing buy. I actually mentioned it in a couple other places earlier today. I know a few people were grabbing copies around like 250 roughly. I think that's a great price, and I think it's worth having a few of those on hand, you know, in case this archetype does take off. I think that card would make its way. It fits the colors, it's on color, it has Afterlife, etc.
Well, so something to keep in mind is that, you know, the best deck in Standard right now is already a Jun sacrifice deck.
Exactly. So
these can like either directly slot into there. I don't know if the colors might switch up.
You're basically expanding.
Like, I don't know if that means it's going to, like, I think it might not be good enough to switch into white, because like the payoff of Mayhem Devil and Korvold are extremely high. Mayhem Devil is just like the best payoff I can even think of. I mean, that card's just nuts.
Insane, yeah. But the thing is, Mayhem Devil, is it 1 red and 1 black? I thought it was 1 red or 1 black.
No, it's 1 black and a red.
Okay, all right. Okay, got it. So you can't go out of those colors then. Well, regardless, right. Seraph of the Scales is a card that I've got my eye on. I'm going to be keeping it. I haven't actually bought copies personally, but it's definitely one that I'm keeping an eye on. I also think the other card I wanted to mention for speculation purposes, because it's got just so much eternal playability, is Leyline of the Void. That card has continued to trend down over the course of its Standard life with the reprint. I could see it making a comeback in Standard itself, just given the potential for graveyard usage. We just talked about the Ox that discards cards as well. And then with Escape being a mechanic in general, being able to keep graveyards clear seems really, really important in this upcoming meta. So I would keep an eye on Leyline of the Void and maybe even Graffdigger's Cage to a lesser extent. I think both of those are worth, you know, consideration in some capacity. Leyline definitely having priority because of its exile capability.
personally, I'm not betting on Leyline as a standard role player anytime soon. But I definitely agree that it is a good, like, a good long-term buy. I mean, it's $8.50 right now. You know, how wrong can you really go with Leyline? Especially, like, yeah. OGs are still really low, and, like, the guild pack art is just never going to stop being extremely beautiful. So, I mean, you can literally buy a guild pack Leyline for the same price as a normal one, which is, it seems pretty sweet to me. I'm definitely going to pick up a set, actually. I'm a huge fan of the art, though.
I just also, one other thought really quickly, and this is kind of broadly for all Leylines, not just Leyline of the Boy, but they naturally add two of their color to the devotion pool. So if there's a devotion deck that comes out and you know, it's running any one of the Leylines that haven't been banned, taking Leyline of Abundance out of the equation, or was that, I guess that was Pioneer that it got banned in, but...
Yeah, still legal and standard.
Right, yeah, so... So any of those ley lines are worth consideration if one of them finds its way into a devotion deck. I think, you know, just keep an eye out for that.
That's a really good point. I actually had not considered that. I'm not sure if black is going to be the right place for devotion in this format. Right. It's possible it might, but that's a really good, especially because like this Erebos is definitely quite good. So it's very possible these decks are going to be playing him. So that actually gives, you know, Leyline of the Void a bit more utility in the sideboard because it powers out Erebos to become a creature earlier. That's something I hadn't considered. So actually, like, picking up Leyline a lot sooner than later is definitely a good idea because these haven't ticked up at all yet. These have been $8 for a hot minute.
I would extend that to kind of all the Leylines from the core set, because I any one of them having the ability to add the two mana to its respective color pool for devotion could be a difference maker, you know, as we get cards. And I think that's something we should all keep in mind as we see more spoilers. All right, so moving on, we are...
Real quick, so we haven't seen Heliod yet, have we? No, we have not.
We have not.
So Leyline of Sanctity is a really good sideboard card often. I don't know if it's like going to be good in the new standard, but that's something to consider is like...
That's a great call.
If Heliod turns out to be a good card, I would definitely buy a lot of Leyline of Sanctities.
I would be shocked if we don't get Heliod, given the fact that we've gotten, you know, some of the brethren, Purphoros and Erebos and stuff. So, and Heliod's got a land in Modern Horizons. So it felt like a little bit of foreshadowing. So that's a great segue, though. I wanted to talk, this might be one of the last things we'll cover in terms of individual cards, but I think it would be great to cover the remaining couple of gods. There's Nihilea and what was the Gruul one? Clothis, God of Destiny. Clothis, yeah, there you go. God of Destiny. I want to just chat about both of those. They're both at the mythic rarity level, so I think they're worth covering. Clothis has already, you know, probably a ship has sailed on that one if there was a reason to actually buy into it at pre-sale. It did come out on Christmas Eve, I think, that it was spoiled. But Nihilea came out today, and it feels really strong. As usual, green gets some more ammunition to its already incredibly deep pool of cards to choose from. I'm going to start by saying that Nihilea is 4 mana, which is a really tough slot in the you know, like the green ramp decks. It's going to be competing with a lot of different things at that slot, but it makes your creatures cost 1 less to cast it. So it's 1 green, 3 generic, 5/6 indestructible, the typical god, you know, status. It's indestructible and its devotion has to be 5 or greater to become a creature. But it makes your creatures cost 1 less to cast. And then for 1 green, 2 generic, you reveal the top card of your library. If it's a creature, you put it in your hand. And if it isn't, you may put it into your graveyard. So I'm assuming you can put it back on the top of your library if you don't want to put it in your graveyard. Great way to fill the yard, you know, a great way to fill the to act as an engine and keep card advantage, or fill your graveyard as needed. So anyway, I wanted to mention that and get your thoughts there.
I personally am pretty low on this card. I think Search for Iskanta that you have to pump 3 mana into every time you want to get a trigger seems pretty lukewarm to me. Getting a lot of that mana refunded back to you as creatures costing 1 less is pretty solid. But when the engine for that already costs 4 mana at that point, like, how much are you really going to get back from that effect? So I personally... I'm not very high on Nihilea. And green is so good right now. It has so many really powerful options that I think Nihilea is going to be pretty fringe magic card in standard and probably not see play outside of standard.
I agree. I don't think it would see any play outside of standard. My take on its playability is that if you're running this, you're likely only going to be running maybe one or two copies at most. So whatever the, I don't know what it came out at in terms of pre-order. I can look that up really quick, but whatever price it came out at, I mean, I'm thinking this becomes like a $3 mythic, at, you know, somewhere in that range. I don't see this being, I don't see it being played as a four of to start with. And I think that alone is, you know, the difference when we were talking about Purphoros earlier and even Erebos in the right shell could be like a three of. I just don't see that being the case for this one. It doesn't give you enough upside to have more than maybe one or two copies.
Yeah, to be fair, the last Nihilia saw some play in like the green ramp strategies in standard, and this one's definitely better than the last one. So maybe, you know, looking down the road when we lose like War of the Spark Nissa, and some of the other really powerful green payoff spells, this could be one of the better green role players in ramp. Like, this card's not terrible. It's just we have such good options for green right now that it's not like something I'm really considering.
Yeah, it's outclassed.
What were you saying?
I was just saying Nihilia is outclassed currently.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely outclassed by the options that are currently available in standard. Going on to Clothis. What do you guys think of this card? I don't really know what to think, honestly. This card's pretty weird.
Yeah, I had kind of a mix. So the reason I like it, I'll start with that because I think that's always important. What I love about it is the exile being open to any graveyard. You don't have to exile a card from your graveyard. And we saw how potent that was. I was really high on Kaya from Ravnica Allegiance when she was spoiled because of her exile. I think it's like exile, I forget what her ability is now, but it exiled a card from a graveyard. It's a +1, I think. Why am I blanking on this? Anyway, her exile ability became extremely important in that particular meta because of the presence of Arclight Phoenix. And so if we do go back to that type of a meta where the graveyard is super important, being able to exile cards from graveyards is, you know, definitely sideboard worthy. Now, whether you'd main deck this, I don't know, but to be able to do that at the beginning of your combat and exile, you know, like a burn spell that has some, not flashback, but that's a bad example, but to be able to exile something at the beginning of your combat that, you know, could become a threat later, I think is reasonable to keep an eye on. So I'll start with that.
It's also I was just going to say, I think this card like has a really good chance of being an excellent one of in like a Gruul aggro deck, like even in the main deck, because it does a decent amount of like what you would want to be doing anyway. You know, gives you an extra mana that you can hopefully like curve with, or it either like, you know, maybe deals 2 damage to your opponent. Getting 7 total devotion to red and green might be kind of tricky. I'm not sure how doable that's going to be for like a Gruul deck, but or like how quickly you're going to be doing that rather. Like, I mean, I guess if you're doing that pretty consistently on turn 4, then, you know, doing 2 damage to your opponent and having a 4/5 indestructible, and it just keeps, you know, generating value for you at your choice every turn, because you can always just exile a non-land, which I'm sure there's going to be plenty of in the graveyard to deal 2 damage to your opponents. And if it matters to have, you know, that incidental graveyard hate, then it's certainly possible that Clothis could be quite a good card, especially, you know, if a lot of these escape cards are seeing play. And you're able to kill an escape card on your opponent's turn, then you get to, you know, trigger this on your turn and just exile it before they can really do anything about it. So there are play patterns that could make this card quite good. But similar to, you know, some of the other softer gods, this is probably like a 1-2 of card at best, if this is even a deck for it.
I like keeping this in like your watch list. Put it in your save for later on your TCG card, for example, and watch the price. The price is going to come down early, I think, because of what we're saying. But this is one of those role players that you keep an eye on, just like Kaya was when she came out. And sure enough, Kaya, I think, tripled at one point. You know, I was pretty high on her from the get go. And I think a lot of people followed suit on picking copies of that of Kaya up. And sure enough, she ended up being extremely potent. Clothis, I think, I don't know that Clothis gets to the Kaya levels of relevance because it's not a planeswalker. But that being said, I will throw this out there. They did just spoil a Field of Ruin reprint, which actually synergizes very, very well with Clothis. You can sacrifice your Field of Ruin. You're going to get a land back out of that, right? So you sack your Field of Ruin, you destroy an opponent's land, they get a basic, you get a basic, and then you've actually got the ability to go into your pre-combat main, or you've got your ability to do that on the end of turn, and then at your pre-combat main phase, go ahead and exile your Field of Ruin, and now you've got an extra mana out of it. I don't know if that'll be relevant. I noticed that little synergy today when Field of Ruin was printed. So these are all things to keep an eye on. I wouldn't recommend pre-ordering this. I don't know where it started, but this feels like the type of card that out of the gates kind of feels some supply pressure and drops out of the gates, and you know, you have an opportunity to pick it up at a cheaper price.
Yeah, it started off high like the rest of the mythics. I think it's still sitting at like $18 right now, which is pretty outrageous for that card. But a lot of these cards are going to come down a whole lot, especially like probably by 2 weeks into the set, I'd say.
So last topic I wanted to get to, well, there's actually two cards that I want to talk about. One is Nyx Lotus, which was just revealed towards the back end of the day here. It's got Lotus in the name, so I think it's worth at least, you know, mentioning it and talking about it briefly. It's a 4-mana legendary artifact. Nyx Lotus enters the battlefield tap, and then you tap it to choose a color, and you add an amount of mana of that color equal to your devotion. So I don't know that this is going to be great out of the gates, but you said something earlier, Sam. You mentioned when Nyssa moves on, right, when she rotates. I could see a scenario where Nyssa rotates and Nyx Lotus slots right into her place as the ramp of choice for a mono-green deck. So I'm only just going to kind of make a quick tidbit here with Nyx Lotus that I would put this on a watch list. I think the extended art foils of this are, one, I think they're going to be absolutely gorgeous. I don't think we saw what that art looks like yet, but I have to imagine that it's going to be gorgeous just based on the art in the card that was spoiled today. So, for one, I would just start with those. I think those are going to be a nice pickup. Let the supply come online and keep an eye on those. But two, I would keep an eye on this card after rotation as a possible ramp spell for a mono green deck if devotion stays powerful. Otherwise, I don't see a ton of playability. And someone asked me about EDH with Nyx Lotus. Nyx Lotus in EDH isn't really that great because, for one, in EDH, you don't see a ton of mono X decks that are mono color decks, that are going to need something like this on a, you're not going to actually get use out of this until turn five if you're hard casting it. I just don't know if that's what you want to be doing in EDH. I'm sure it'll see play, but I'm not as high on this card as I would maybe have expected to be out of the gates. So anyway, those are kind of my thoughts on Nyx Lotus.
I agree with every word you said. Just having it come to play tap just is really lukewarm.
If it comes in untapped, it's definitely going to see play.
I mean, it's definitely going to see play. It's just, is it going to be crazy? No, I mean, it's just a 4-mana mana rock that comes into play tapped, you know?
This feels like the safest way to print this, basically.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah, no, that is a good point. I think this one, they definitely took the conservative route. If you have a way, and one thing I was just thinking, if you have a way to untap artifacts, I wonder if this could see play more in like a mono-colored artifact deck built around like Emry, or maybe even if we expand out to Modern, we go to like Urza. Urza gets another tool here with ramp. Again, though, I don't think you need that. Like, I just don't see this as a card that fits really into any of those shells very well. So,
I'm desperately trying to think of like the best applications for this, and it's like, I guess if you have $1,000 to spend on the Mishra's Workshop, it's pretty good.
Right, exactly. So, all right. So moving on. Last card I want to cover, and then we had a couple questions in chat that I want to cover before we wrap up here. So I want to talk about this misprint that was spoiled today. It was Temple of Abandon extended art. The color scheme on the text box appears to be black and green rather than red and green. So they spoiled, I don't know who the content creator was that actually spoiled the Scrylands today, but they had actually access to both arts, both the regular art and then the extended frame version. And side by side, you can very, very clearly see that the Temple of Abandon extended art is black compared to red. And if you're looking for even more confirmation, look up Temple of Deceit and compare the two. Temple of Deceit is blue and black, and it's clear as day that the black on both cards is the same. So we were talking about this before cast. Sam, you brought this up, and I wanted to let you expand on your thoughts, because I think it's a really, really good kind of a niche place to play. If these truly make it to print with this black and green as opposed to red and green, they do become a misprint. And to your point from precast, I'll just reiterate this. You said that there's a chance that they could clean this up, right? So maybe the first wave has black and green, and then everything is cleaned up after that, just like they did with Corpse Knight with the 2-3 versus 2-2. And so I think we were kind of collectively as a group talking about what that meant for the card. And I'll let you expand on your take here.
Yeah, so I think from a logistics standpoint, we know Wizards of the Coast, if they do allow any of these to see the light of day, if any of these actually get printed, they're not going to be that many. You know, at the very most, there's going to be what we had with the Corpse Knight, where you can only find these at the pre-release, but they caught them before they like actually get on the shelves, or you know, maybe they're in the first like print run, but the second these things get restocked, those are gone. Because Wizards has at least some semblance of quality control and will not just allow this to sit around forever. So we know if we do see any of these in paper, they're not going to be that many of them. Secondly, speaking from someone who thinks misprints are cool and has some decent understanding of the value of that specific misprints bring, this could be a relatively expensive misprint because it is solely on the extended art versions of cards. So it's possible, like, let's say, for example, if this is only in the pre-release, that means it wouldn't be in the collector's boosters, the main way to get the extended art versions of this. So there's really not going to be that many running around. And then the foil versions, the foil extended art could, you know, have this similar misprint. So the amount of foil extended arts of this one specific card that you get open in just the pre-release window, that's got to be really, really small amount of cards. So but we did like see that Theros got leaked. You know, someone found some random packs at a Walgreens or something. So I don't know the way Wizards distribution works. Like, I really don't understand it at this point. So I don't know what to think. I just know that if we see a single one of these in paper, and if you're able to buy it, you absolutely should. Because there are not going to be very many of this card at all. I'm thinking like very conservatively, like, This one will be worth twice what a normal one would be worth. But honestly, like on the foil floor, the supply could be so low that maybe this is worth, 10 or 20 times as much as a normal one. On the flip side, it's also possible this doesn't even exist. Maybe it was just an error in the graphic or they catch it before it actually gets to the printer.
All of those great points and all, I think it's one of those like wait and see, but it's something to kind of put like a little asterisk next to as a reminder when these do hit shelves and we see the first, the first person on Twitter that tweets out, "I pulled a foil Temple of Abandon, but it's black and green instead of red and green." What is, that confirmation will kind of dictate, one, that it exists, and then two, start to navigate what the response should be. Again, to your point, if they immediately clean this up and there's only a handful of those printed in the first wave, that would be pretty amazing. I mean, those cards would certainly command a legitimate, if not significant, premium. I think the Corpse Knight misprint, which was only in, keep me honest on this, I think it was only in pre-release decks that happened. So there were like very few, but those were going for $10 to $12. So, I mean, it's, and that was like a non-foil. That was just a basic uncommon, but it wasn't uncommon because it was a misprint. So anyway, something to think about. We just wanted to mention that and call it out, kind of a unique angle to think about.
Using the Corpse Knight comparison, like Corpse Knight is just a normal uncommon. There are tons of those open in a pre-release. And even that was, able to command some amount of money. But this is an extended art rare. It's not on the normal playable version of the rare. It's only on the extended art rare. That also has that like an extended art foil variant.
Right. Not that Corpse Knight wasn't playable, but I mean, it's an extended art foil playable rare with a lot of demand from EDH. Corpse Knight does not have the same demand as Temple of Abandon by any stretch of imagination when it comes to EDH. So I just was looking it up. Corpse Knight's misprint now is worth 10 cents. So it's kind of funny because I remember these were going for like $10 at one point, and now it's just a regular. It's just a regular in common.
There wound up being a lot of those. Those got to the point where, you know, like every LGS would have a few, but that's just not going to be true for this. If there are any, of course, asterisk.
Right. So, all right. So wrapping that up, I wanted to take these last two questions and then we'll go ahead and close down the cast here. The first question was from BioSpark. What is the most overhyped and the most underhyped Theros card from the spoilers we've seen so far?
So I think it depends on how you want to ask that question, right? Is it overhyped in terms of like playability, or is it overhyped in terms of price? Because I think in raw price, so many of these cards are like clearly overhyped, right? Like we've got a stack of $10 bulk rares being previewed.
Why don't we do why don't we answer this question from a couple angles? We'll try to keep it concise in the interest of time. But why don't we pick maybe like one card overhyped, one card underhyped from playability and from value standpoint? I'll start, and I think I'm going to just take an easy one. It's Purphoros underhyped from a price standpoint with SCG at $9.99. If they restock on that, I will just totally transparently say I already put my email address in to be notified on the restock. If that comes back at $9.99, y'all are going to have to wait for another restock, because I'm absolutely going to be trying to jump in and grabbing as many copies of that as I can at that price. I think $9.99 for Purphoros is extremely low. I think that card is going to see a tremendous amount of play, and I that's my personal take. So I'll start there. Sam or Kerberry, you guys have one that you want to cover next?
Go ahead first, Kerberry. Still one of mine.
Let's see. If I had to pick like one kind of underhyped card, I'll start with that. I think the Elspeth, the main Planeswalker one that we're getting, not the Planeswalker deck, but the main inset Planeswalker we're getting, I think that's not getting as much fanfare as we're going to be seeing in the coming months here. I think this card is incredibly powerful, and it's the fact that it's so repeatable is going to prove it to be a player in Standard coming up, at least.
Elspeth, Undaunted Hero?
Sun's Nemesis.
Sun's Nemesis, gotcha. Undaunted Heroes, probably. I'm glad you clarified that, because I think, yeah, my bad. Yep. So Sun's Nemesis.
That is the Planeswalker deck one.
Oh my goodness. You could pick these up for $14 right now. That's crazy. That's so low for a standard Planeswalker that like could see play.
Yeah, exactly. And just to add to that too, the alternate art version, especially if we get foils of these, those are sweet. Like there's very few cards in Magic that look like this right now, and I think that's going to add a lot of a wow factor to it as well.
Yeah, that's really cool. Those are going at like 115 right now, which is pretty high, but those come down, I'd definitely look at it.
The art on those the art on this card is gorgeous.
Man, I'm gonna buy some $14 Elspeths. Like I was seeing this card at like 20 before, which I was like kind of close on, because like, I mean, obviously it's no 3-mana busted Planeswalker, but I definitely think this card is like solid, and there's not necessarily a deck for it right now, and white's been a pretty weak color, but I would not be at all surprised to see that change in the near future. And this is just like a really well-costed, strong Planeswalker. It's just got, you know, it's a 4-mana, 5 loyalty with all relevant abilities that flashes back. Like, I think it's pretty reasonable to bet that this is going to be a good Magic card at some point in some context.
One thing I was concerned about with Elspeth is that there's no way to protect it in her abilities. She doesn't, all of her abilities are minuses, and none of them actually protect it. Now, that being said, it has escape. So to your point of the recursion, Groberry, you can just get it back. So maybe that doesn't actually matter. But I was thinking about this, and I'm just going to play devil's advocate. Is for 4 mana, or, you know, for 4 mana, is the payoff of 5 life or 2/1/1 soldiers, or, you know, maybe beefing up your creatures by +2/+1. Is that payoff enough on turn 4, do we think? That would be my question.
You make a reasonable point. Yeah. Or -3 is just like textless pretty much too. Like, who wants to lose 3 loyalty on your 4-mana Planeswalker to gain 5 life?
I don't know.
Even if it has flashback, who cares, right? Like, that's a lot of resources to put into gaining 5 life, which I think you can do. Like, there's so much food going around in Standard. Having her on the back end of Eldraine is definitely some pretty big shoes to fill.
I will agree with that. Like, most of the abilities here are unassuming. They're not super powerful on their own. I think we may see a point in Standard and kind of what you're speaking to, where things slow down a little bit, where the power level kind of chokes downward, and we're going to see like repeatable abilities, things that just keep coming back, grinding your opponents out. That might be strong enough.
Gotcha. Yeah, more of a grindy format. Yeah, right now it's definitely the opposite.
Yeah, it's definitely going to depend on the context of the format. So, I mean, maybe it's a wait and see, but $14 is not like a terrible point to get in for a, you know, new Mythic Planeswalker. My pick for the most underhyped, I've got a two-way tie here for Ox of Agonis, because it's previewing a little bit lower than then some of the other Mythics that are in the mid-range. So, like, Erebos and Clothis are going for, like, 18s, but you can find the Ox for, like, 14 or 15. I think the Ox is the second best mythic that's been previewed so far, right behind Purphoros. And it's, I think it's the best one that's been printed for Eternal play, not counting Underworld Breach and Legacy. I think this card, I just can't explain how busted I think it is, but I think it is heinously busted. Additionally, I think Woe Strider is a little bit underhyped right now. Woe Strider is only previewing for like $5 right now, when we have all these like super medium looking rares previewing for like $8 or $9. It definitely feels like this card might be getting underhyped right now. If it crawls a little bit further down to like the $2 range, I'm probably going to buy some. Definitely the kind of card that could just wind up a bulk rare, but I think it's like relatively safe to bet on. Ox, on the other hand, there's just no chance this card is a bulk rare. I mean, Ox is an extremely safe place to put your money. Overhyped, probably. I mean, most of them, almost everything is overhyped, I think, at this point. A lot of cards are previewing extremely high. And the reason for that is, you know, a couple of these cards that we were seeing in the beginning of the previews were quite weak. And Wizards also said that they were scaling back the power level of sets beginning with Theros. So I think when a couple of good cards starting to get previewed, everyone's like, oh, okay, this is going to be like the chase card of the set. But today we saw 10 or more different really powerful rares and mythics, and they just can't all be $10 or $20, but they've all managed to preview that so far. So I expect, I don't even want to just like name one card, because I expect more than 10 of these to fall from literally $10 to like bulk rare status, which is kind of an embarrassing misevaluation of cards on vendors' parts. But I guess Storm Herald is the number one pick for right now. Storm Herald is not going to stay at $9.
Yeah, I agree with that one. And I agree with your overall assessment. I will pivot, and I'm going to say Galia of the Endless Dance. I think from an EDH standpoint, I wanted to throw this out there, and I might just make a closing remark on this when we wrap up the cast. But one thing I'm noticing also about the design so far of these cards is how they don't seem super EDH focused or influenced, which I'm actually loving, because EDH feels like was just beaten to death with options over the course of 2019. And so far I haven't really seen a single card that's like, oh my gosh, we have to have that in EDH, or we have to build a commander deck around that. Anyway, Galia of the Endless Dance is the Gruul Satyr 2/2 haste. Other satyrs get +1/+1 in haste. It's basically tribal satyr, or you know, a tribal satyr lord. The hype around this has already driven Willow Satyr, which is a reserveless card, up to nearly double its value. It was listed for around $30, 30 to 35 before, and now you're seeing copies on TCG Player for 60 plus. I would be very cautious in chasing this. I don't see this being like a super sustainable deck in EDH. I think Satyrs even if they get some support in Theros, which I would have to assume they will if they're giving us a Lord, I just can't see there being a scenario where there's enough Satyrs to make a truly playable EDH tribal Satyr deck without the use of like shapeshifters and things like that. So that's my overhyped card. Not so much from a price standpoint, more from like a playability standpoint.
That's reasonable. I think that it's reasonable to look at Satyrs as more of a Minotaur adjacent tribe, where, you know, people keep going like, oh, it's going to be a thing, and then it's not a thing because it's not Goblins, Elves, or Merfolk, and then back into obscurity it goes. Willow Satyr, yeah, I mean, I'm staying away from it, but like, it's cool that it gets haste from Galia. I also think like Galia is going to be a pretty popular card. Like, the art on it is super cute. And it's definitely like got a lot of like good stuff on this one magic card. Like, it's definitely a power level or a high power level card, but it's also legendary for being a lord, which is, you know, pretty sizable drawback on your two drop. This is the kind of two drop that you would want to jam for in your deck, except, you know, being a legendary makes that pretty difficult. So I don't really know where this is going to go, but I don't think it's going to bulk status.
And the nice thing would have been is if it wasn't discarded at random, you could just discard, you know, extra copies you have in your hand when you attack with it. But unfortunately, it's a discard at random. So running four of these will be kind of tricky. I will say this in full transparency. I actually did buy Xenagos the Reveler when this card was spoiled. So I did buy copies of that in response to it. But I'm kind of mostly just assuming there's going to be a hype train for it rather than longevity. So. Right. Crowberry, do you have an overhype that you want to, before we answer the last question?
I have an overhype. Why don't I just be contrary and I say, I'll say Purphoros is overhyped.
Ooh, I like it. Like it. Oh, I like it. I like it. I like that.
I think the card's interesting, but it has all the makings of a deck that's flat on its face. You don't draw the right cards, at least for standard. Maybe not for other formats, but.
Rary says this and then hops on Arena in about 3 weeks and gets Dracky Seth on turn four and is like, oh my God, what happened?
Hell yeah, brother.
I'm going to, just to prove you wrong, I'm going to make a competitive standard deck that is literally 100 cards to show you how good Big Red is.
Oh, please do. I'd love to see it.
This deck has so many options. I think, like, between four Ilharg, four of every rare that has been in red that's gotten printed or previewed so far, I think it's going to be a pretty strong deck. I think Purphoros is one of the best cards in it.
I'm going to grind up to, like, Mythic on Arena with Purphoros. all right, so to wrap this up, we've got one last question from Dr. Hayes, and I'm going to give kind of a broad answer on this because we are a little over time already. The question was, I'm getting back into the finance game. What's my best bet to get things going again? I'm going to give a generic statement here. I definitely want your guys' take on this. I don't want to spend a lot of time because, to be honest, if you're just getting back into finance, it's the typical, you know, there's a lot of different things to be considering. My personal take on it right now, and this is actually what my philosophy has been with my store in terms of speculation and things like that. I've actually been very, very, very quiet on the speculation front. I have not been pulling the trigger on hardly anything that seems like a good speculative pickup. I would strongly encourage using the Discord, using Quiet Speculation Discord, and keep an eye on, particularly as Theros spoilers are coming on, you know, being prepared to grab cards for your inventory that are going to, you know, be in demand. I wouldn't necessarily feel a rush right now that you have to spend money, though. I think that overall, the Magic market is extremely quiet, and it will continue to be that way for the near term. I do believe that we'll see a little bit of a resurgence once we get through, you know, these kind of next 4 to 8 weeks, January, February. It's always quieter on the holidays and typically even into, you know, the early part of, or the late part of winter, early part of spring. Once the tax dollars, the tax season kind of rolls around, we know that that's every year it seems like there's a correlation to tax season kind of, I don't know if that naturally is infusing money and people are spending their tax refunds, or, you know, that's kind of the presumption. I don't know that we should assume that because we don't know that, but a lot of people make that assumption. Regardless, I think once you get into March or April, there's going to be more opportunities kind of widespread. Things like Modern Horizons are going to start to rebound. You'll see more of a widespread playability because Modern support's going to exist. Pioneer support is already, you know, it's kind of cooled off, but I think that's going to resurge with all the events that are going to be coming up in January and beyond. And then I think we're going to get a fresh standard. So you're going to have kind of this plethora of opportunity. But as it stands, my personal advice, Dr. Hayes, and to anyone else who's, you know, kind of questioning on the MTG finance side, I'd keep quiet. I would lay low and just be patient and not necessarily feel a need to go out and buy a card right now.
Yeah, I think it says a lot when both Chris and I, and, you know, possibly Crowberry, I can't really speak for him, but he'll let you know after I'm done talking. We're all pretty bearish right now. And, you know, usually we come in this cast and we've got all these great specs to tell you about. But right now, we're all pretty quiet, not like throwing all of our money. It's, I mean, I threw all my money at Secret Lair, and I know Chris did too. And I'm sure you're just as happy with that as I was. That was pretty sweet. But, you know, that's something you have to kind of just follow the Quiet Speculation Discord for, because the window on these things is usually pretty, pretty tight. One thing I did pretty recently, like my most recent finance thing that I did before Secret Lair, was I just bought almost like 4 to 8, sometimes more, of everything that could become a staple in Pioneer. And honestly, it didn't cost that much. Like the whole format is extremely cheap currently still, because the print runs are just so high of everything. But the payoff really is there. I purchased, I think, 5 or 6 copies of the Scarab God for like 15s or 13s. I got a couple of foil copies as well for like 20. And just recently, he's finally seen play in Pioneer. So as of about a week ago, I think, he spiked up to a little bit, like around $30 for the non-foil and $50 for the foil. And I have a whole stack of other cards that, you know, are just Pioneer legal, and there's like kind of a deck for it, but it's, you know, not at the top of the metagame right now. And eventually, you know, it'll 5-0 enough leagues that people will start buying more copies and the cards from it will spike. So that's kind of my only real plan for Magic Finance right now, is just to keep hold on to my Pioneer stuff and selling into the spikes. What do you think, Crowberry? Are you as bearish as we are, or do you have some more direct spec tips?
I have to kind of mirror what you were just saying there, because that's almost exactly what I've been doing. Just buying cheap Pioneer cards, things that I think will pop off later or could pop off later. I'll give one little tip that I could be completely wrong on, but I've been pretty hype on the deck building aspect, so it's tainted my view of it a little bit. But that card is Metalwork Colossus, and I think that's kind of an interesting card to brew around right now. And those are the kinds of cards I'm buying for Pioneer, just things that you can brew around, things that could be. And then just the little movers like lands, all of the not just shocks, but the fast lands, things like that are little, that'll have consistent movement. I think those are good places to put your money right now. And that's kind of where I've been at lately.
Yeah. Let me see here. Colossus. I was just Googling this because
I like that one.
Actually, I don't like Metalwork Colossus. I do think that's a card that's going to see more play than it is right now. But Metalwork Colossus was extremely overprinted and doesn't have like a historical high price metal. And I'm looking it up on Librarians right now. Yeah, 2017, the gift pack had like guaranteed copies of like Metalwork Colossus in it.
Foils that are curled, but
okay, true. I'm just saying, like, I feel like there's a ton of Metalwork Colossus out there. Like the supply is like extremely deep, and there's not like a ton of people who, well, I don't know, I could be wrong. The thing is about, like, the thing that's great about Pioneer is, like, Metalwork Colossus is, like, 50 cents right now. So, you know,
exactly.
If it becomes, like, the best deck in Pioneer, well, even if it is a huge supply, it'll still go up to, like, $2 or $3 or something, and then you're, like, tripling your money.
One of the things that's, Kruber, it's really interesting you just brought up lands, because I think it was the last time we cast it was probably almost 2 months ago, and Pioneer was pretty much brand new, and one of the things we kind of collectively as a group really harped on was investing in lands. And you're absolutely right that the lands themselves are still in a lot of ways undervalued. There's still opportunity there. We've seen the pain lands really spike lately. You know, there's this kind of concept of a Pioneer Tron deck that's been starting to post, or, you know, starting to post some results. But there's always opportunity for these lands, the Scry lands especially. Seem like another, you know, kind of intriguing one to keep an eye on, especially at rotation. I think Scrylands are going to be really, really great. And then same with Shocklands. Shocklands will rotate in about, what, 9 months or so, give or take. And when they rotate and they kind of see a sell-off, I think those are always going to be just great cards to buy at their lows.
Yeah, for sure. And if you've taken us, like, I mean, Mana Confluence specifically is one of the ones we mentioned that hasn't really gone up yet. But if you've taken us saying, like, oh, invest in the lands, to mean, like, well, you know, I'm going to look at the lands that are seeing play and buy into those as it comes. There was like a great time to buy Shibben Reef. We're at, you know, $2 or a little bit less than $2. And if you had done so, you know, in between the last time we podcasted and now, you'd be pretty happy sitting on, you know, $2 Shibben Reefs where they're at like $4 to $5 now for, you know, near mint one. So the lands are definitely, a lot of the lands are definitely still being undervalued.
The record, Sam, Mana Confluence was my call, and it was $12 when I called it, and you could sell them for $30 for a stretch. So I definitely think that
$12 when we called it on the cast.
Yeah, it was $12 when I was like all over that card when Pioneer was announced. It was you're right.
It had already spiked by the time we were casting. I could be wrong, but I thought it had already gotten 20. But you were right. There was a time to sell at 30.
Entirely possible it was by the time we cast it. I was all over it in actionable purchasing, though, and I got like told that it wasn't playable, which ironically I guess it actually hasn't been that playable because it hasn't seen a ton of play in Pioneer yet. But it's just funny because it did do very well. It almost tripled at one point. So
no, you definitely called it. You definitely called it.
Yeah, so all right, well, that was a nice wrap up. I think, you know, the summary here for Dr. Hayes, for your question, if you are getting into finance, or if you're, you know, if you're just kind of getting back into it, don't necessarily, and this is good advice always, I wouldn't use it as just this particular point in time, be patient. Patience is always really important with anything you do with money. Keeping yourself in a, you know, very disciplined mentality. Don't feel like you have to chase everything. We always say that in Quiet Spec. You'll hear it from all the different writers and content creators within the company. But patience is key, and discipline is key when you're generally talking about investing in anything. So I would encourage folks right now, especially, you know, to kind of recap what Sam said, we are feeling pretty bearish on the Magic market. That doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad time. It's not necessarily a bad time to start picking up things like Modern Horizons, Pioneer Specs. You know, when they're at their lows like that, there's a famous saying by Warren Buffett, when others are greedy, be fearful. And when others are fearful, be greedy. I think this is a great time to kind of look at it like people are being fearful. So find the right cards and maybe be greedy, because there will be a rebound. It'll be coming. It's just a matter of when, not if. So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, great mention there. Modern Horizons has to be at their lowest. Like some of these, we've got cards that are equivalent to Horizon Canopy and seeing more play that are like $3. It's pretty crazy.
I love the lands for Modern Horizons right now. Modern has a lot of support in 2020, and it's being slept on in a big way. I think if you're looking for places to maybe speculate and park some long-term cash on in Magic, Modern is a great place to do it because all of the cards in Modern are at or near, really near, maybe even their all-time lows, definitely recent, you know, last 2 years lows. But yeah, Modern Horizons especially, we just saw Morophon start to increase in price. It basically doubled in the last couple of weeks here. That was, I think, a mix of some Modern testing with Slivers and then also EDH demand. Those two things kind of correlated well because of the secret layer Sliver Overlord printing. But that being said, I think Morophon is just the beginning. I mean, there's plenty of great cards in Magic or Modern Horizons that have an opportunity to really start ascending with Modern support coming online again. So if you need your Urzas, for example, those are, you know, unless they get banned in Modern, Urza is at its all-time low. It's approaching $20 last I checked. And you know, so that's a card, for example, I'm stuck on. I bought those at $30 and I, you know, I'm kind of just sitting on them hoping that they'll rebound. But I think that's one that just sees so much play. It's too good of a card to be $20 long-term, in my opinion. Anyway, all right. Well, so we're a little over time here. Why don't we go ahead and wrap up? I did see another question come in about Japanese War of the Spark. I'll go ahead and put some thoughts on that for you, Kawhi, in the chat here. We'll go ahead and wrap up the cast. I think it was a great last cast of 2019 in the decade, and so we'll send it off on a bang and look forward to casting our first time next Monday in 2020.
Kramer, you want to start us off?
Yeah, I just wanted to say thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thanks, everybody, for coming. I really appreciate you. It's been a pleasure podcasting with you in this decade, the 2010s. looking forward to the roaring 20s of MTG Finance.
Yeah, happy new year, everyone. If you're listening to this, likely after the fact, it'll be posted probably sometime in the first or second day of the new year. So happy new year, and thanks for tuning in.
See you guys.